Chapter 49. Appeared a vegetable treasury, while the smell of sweet herbs, and all kinds of wholesome growth, to say nothing of the neighboring meadows, where the hay was carrying, made the whole air a great nosegay. Such stillness and composure reigned within the orderly precincts of the old red wall that even the feathers hung in garlands, to scare the birds hardly stirred. And the wall had such a ripening influence that where, here and there high up, a disused nail and scrap of list still clung to it, it was easy to fancy that they had mellowed with the changing seasons, and that they had rusted and decayed according to the common fate. The house, though a little disorderly in comparison with the garden, was a real old house with settles in the chimney of the brick-floored kitchen, and great beams across the ceilings. On one side of it was the terrible piece of ground in dispute, where Mr. Boythorn maintained a sentry in a smock frock day and night, whose duty was supposed to be, in cases of aggression, immediately to ring a large bell hung up there for the purpose, to unchain a great bulldog established in a kennel as his ally, and generally to deal destruction on the enemy. Not content with these precautions, Mr. Boythorn had himself composed and posted there, on painted boards to which his name was attached in large letters, the following solemn warnings. Beware of the bulldog. He is most ferocious. Lawrence Boythorn. The blunderbuss is loaded with slugs. Lawrence Boythorn. Man traps and spring guns are set here at all times of the day and night. Lawrence Boythorn. Take notice that any person or persons audaciously presuming to trespass on this property will be punished with the utmost severity of private chastisement and prosecuted with the utmost rigor of the law. Lawrence Boythorn. These he showed us from the drawing room window while his bird was hopping about his head, and he laughed, ha 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 ha, ha 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 ha, to that extent as he pointed them out that I really thought he would have hurt himself. But this is taking a good deal of trouble, said Mr. Skimpole in his light way, when you are not in earnest after all. Not in earnest, returned Mr. Boythorn with unspeakable warmth. Not in earnest. If I could have hoped to train him, I would have bought a lion instead of that dog, and would have turned him loose upon the first intolerable robber who should dare to make an encroachment on my rights. Let Sir Leicester Dedlock consent to come out and decide this question by single combat, and I will meet him with any weapon known to mankind in any age or country. I am that much in earnest. Not more. We arrived at his house on a Saturday. On the Sunday morning we all set forth to walk to the little church in the park. Entering the park, almost immediately by the disputed ground, we pursued a pleasant footpath winding among the verdant turf and the beautiful trees until it brought us to the church porch. The congregation was extremely small, and quite a rustic one with the exception of a large muster of servants from the house, some of whom were already in their seats, while others were yet dropping inches. There were some stately footmen, and there was a perfect picture of an old coachman, who looked as if he were the official representative of all the pomps and vanities that had ever been put into his coach. There was a very pretty show of young women, and above them, the handsome old face and fine responsible portly figure of the housekeeper towered preeminent. The pretty girl of whom Mr. Boythorn had told us was close by her. She was so very pretty that I might have known her by her beauty, even if I had not seen how blushingly conscious she was of the eyes of the young fisherman, whom I discovered not far off. One face, and not an agreeable one, though it was handsome, seemed maliciously watchful of this pretty girl, and indeed of everyone and everything there. It was a Frenchwoman's. As the bell was yet ringing, and the great people were not yet come, I had leisure to glance over the church, which smelt as earthy as a grave, and to think what a shady, ancient, solemn little church it was. The windows, heavily shaded by trees, admitted a subdued light that made the faces around me pale, and darkened the old brasses in the pavement, and the time and damp-worn monuments, and rendered the sunshine in the little porch, where a monotonous ringer was working at the bell, inestimably bright. but a stir in that direction, a gathering of reverential awe in the rustic faces, and a blandly ferocious assumption on the part of Mr. Boythorn of being resolutely unconscious of somebody's existence forewarned me that the great people were come, and that the service was going to begin. Enter not into judgment with thy servant, O Lord, for in thy sight shall I ever forget the rapid beating at my heart, occasioned by the look I met as I stood up. Shall I ever forget the manner in which those handsome proud eyes seemed to spring out of their languor, and to hold mine? It was only a moment, before I cast mine down released again, if I may say so on my book, but I knew the beautiful face quite well in that short space of time. And, very strangely, there was something quickened within me, associated with the lonely days at my godmother's. Yes, away even to the days when I had stood on tiptoe to dress myself at my little glass after dressing my doll. And this, although I had never seen this lady's face before in all my life, I was quite sure of it, absolutely certain. It was easy to know that the ceremonious, gouty, gray-haired gentleman, the only other occupant of the great pew, was Sir Leicester Dedlock, and that the lady was Lady Dedlock. But why her face should be, in a confused way, like a broken glass to me, in which I saw scraps of old remembrances, and why I should be so fluttered and troubled, for I was still, by having casually met her eyes, I could not think. I felt it to be an unmeaning weakness in me, and tried to overcome it by attending to the words I heard. Then, very strangely, I seemed to hear them, not in the reader's voice, but in the well-remembered voice of my godmother. This made me think, did Lady Dedlock's face accidentally resemble my godmother's? It might be that it did, a little, but the expression was so different, and the stern decision which had worn into my godmother's face, like weather into rocks, was so completely wanting in the face before me, that it could not be that resemblance which had struck me. Neither did I know the loftiness and haughtiness of Lady Dedlock's face, at all, in any one. And yet I, little Esther Summerson, the child who lived a life apart and on whose birthday there was no rejoicing, seemed to arise before my own eyes, evoked out of the past by some power in this fashionable lady, whom I not only entertained no fancy that I had ever seen, but whom I perfectly well knew I had never seen until that hour. It made me tremble so, to be thrown into this unaccountable agitation, that I was conscious of being distressed even by the observation of the French maid, though I knew she had been looking watchfully here, and there, and everywhere, from the moment of her coming into the church. By degrees, though very slowly, I at last overcame my strange emotion. After a long time, I looked towards Lady Dedlock again. It was while they were preparing to sing, before the sermon. She took no heed of me, and the beating at my heart was gone. Neither did it revive for more than a few moments, when she once or twice afterwards glanced at Ada, or at me through her glass. The service being concluded, Sir Leicester gave his arm with much taste and gallantry to Lady Dedlock, though he was obliged to walk by the help of a thick stick, and escorted her out of church to the pony carriage in which they had come. The servants then dispersed, and so did the congregation, whom Sir Leicester had contemplated all along. Mr. Skimpole said to Mr. Boythorn's infinite delight, as if he were a considerable landed proprietor in heaven. "He believes he is," said Mr. Boythorn. "He firmly believes it. So did his father, and his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. Do you know," pursued Mr. Skimpole very unexpectedly to Mr. Boythorn, "it's agreeable to me to see a man of that sort." "Is it?" said Mr. Boythorn. "Say that he wants to patronize me," pursued Mr. Skimpole. "Very well. I don't object." "I do," said Mr. Boythorn with great vigor. "Do you really?" returned Mr. Skimpole in his easy light vein. "But that's taking trouble, surely. And why should you take trouble? Here am I, content to receive things childishly as they fall out, and I never take trouble. I come down here, for instance, and I find a mighty potentate exacting homage. Very well. I say, mighty potentate, here is my homage. It's easier to give it than to withhold it. Here it is. If you have anything of an agreeable nature to show me, I shall be happy to see it. If you have anything of an agreeable nature to give me, I shall be happy to accept it. Apostrophe mighty potentate replies in effect, this is a sensible fellow. I find him accord with my digestion and my bilious system. He doesn't impose upon me the necessity of rolling myself up like a hedgehog with my points outward. I expand, I open, I turn my silver lining outward like Milton's cloud, and it's more agreeable to both of us. Apostrophe, that's my view of such things, speaking as a child. But suppose you went down somewhere else tomorrow, said Mr. Boythorn, where there was the opposite of that fellow, or of this fellow. How then? How then? Said Mr. Skimpole with an appearance of the utmost simplicity and candor. Just the same then. I should say, my esteemed Boythorn, to make you the personification of our imaginary friend, my esteemed Boythorn, you object to the mighty potentate? Very good. So do one. I take it, that my business in the social system is to be agreeable. I take it, that everybody's business in the social system is to be agreeable. It's a system of harmony, in short. Therefore, if you object, I object. Now, excellent Boythorn, let us go to dinner. Apostrophe, but excellent Boythorn might say, returned our host, swelling, and growing very red, I'll be, I understand, said Mr. Skimpole. Very likely he would. If I will go to dinner, cried Mr. Boythorn in a violent burst and stopping, to strike his stick upon the ground. And he would probably add, is there such a thing as principle, Mr. Harold Skimpole? Apostrophe, to which Harold Skimpole would reply, you know, he returned in his gayest manner, and with his most ingenuous smile, upon my life I have not the least idea. I don't know what it is you call by that name, or where it is, or who possesses it. If you possess it, and find it comfortable, I am quite delighted, and congratulate you heartily. But I know nothing about it, I assure you. For I am a mere child, and I lay no claim to it, and I don't want it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, so, you see, excellent Boythorn and I would go to dinner after all. This was one of many little dialogues between them which I always expected to end, and which I dare say, would have ended under other circumstances, in some violent explosion on the part of our host. But he had so high a sense of his hospitable and responsible position as our entertainer, and my guardian laughed so sincerely at and with Mr. Skimpole, as a child who blew bubbles, and broke them all day long, that matters never went beyond this point. Mr. Skimpole, who always seemed quite unconscious of having been on delicate ground, then betook himself to beginning some sketch in the park which he never finished, or to playing fragments of airs on the piano, or to singing scraps of songs, or to lying down on his back under a tree, and looking at the sky which he couldn't help thinking, he said, was what he was meant for. It suited him so exactly. Enterprise and effort, he would say to us on his back, are delightful to me. I believe I am truly cosmopolitan. I have the deepest sympathy with them. I lie in a shady place like this, and think of adventurous spirits going to the North Pole or penetrating to the heart of the torrid zone with admiration. Mercenary creatures ask, what is the use of a man's going to the North Pole? What good does it do? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I can't say, but, for anything I can say, he may go for the purpose, though he don't know it of employing my thoughts as I lie here. Take an extreme case. Take the case of the slaves on American plantations. I dare say they are worked hard, I dare say they don't altogether like it. I dare say theirs is an unpleasant experience on the whole. But they people the landscape for me, they give it a poetry for me, and perhaps that is one of the pleasanter objects of their existence. I am very sensible of it, if it be, and I shouldn't wonder if it were. I always wondered on these occasions whether he ever thought of Mrs. Skimpole and the children, and in what point of view they presented themselves to his cosmopolitan mind. So far as I could understand, they rarely presented themselves at all. The week had gone round to the Saturday following that beating of my heart in the church, and every day had been so bright and blue that to ramble in the woods and to see the light striking down among the transparent leaves and sparkling in the beautiful interlacings of the shadows of the trees, while the birds poured out their songs and the air was drowsy with the hum of insects, had been most delightful. We had one favorite spot, deep in moss and last year's leaves, where there were some felled trees from which the bark was all stripped off. Seated among these, we looked through a green vista supported by thousands of natural columns, the whitened stems of trees, upon a distant prospect made so radiant by its contrast with the shade in which we sat and made, so precious by the arched perspective through which we saw it, that it was like a glimpse of the better land. Upon the Saturday we sat here, Mr. Jarndyce, Ada, and I, until we heard thunder muttering in the distance, and felt the large raindrops rattle through the leaves. The weather had been all the week extremely sultry, but the storm broke so suddenly upon us, at least, in that sheltered spot that, before we reached the outskirts of the wood, the thunder and lightning were frequent, and the rain came plunging through the leaves, as if every drop were a great leaden bead. As it was not a time for standing among trees, we ran out of the wood, and up and down the moss-grown steps which crossed the plantation fence like two broad staved ladders placed back to back, and made for a keeper's lodge which was close at hand. We had often noticed the dark beauty of this lodge standing in a deep twilight of trees, and how the ivy clustered over it, and how there was a steep hollow near, where we had once seen the keeper's dog dive down into the fern, as if it were water. The lodge was so dark within, now the sky was overcast, that we only clearly saw the man who came to the door, when we took shelter there and put two chairs for Ada and me. The lattice windows were all thrown open, and we sat just within the doorway watching the storm. It was grand to see how the wind awoke, and bent the trees, and drove the rain before it like a cloud of smoke, and to hear the solemn thunder, and to see the lightning, and while thinking with awe of the tremendous powers by which our little lives are encompassed, to consider how beneficent they are, and how upon the smallest flower and leaf there was already a freshness poured from all this seeming rage which seemed to make creation new again. Is it not dangerous to sit in so exposed a place? Oh, no, Esther dear, said Ada quietly. Ada said it to me, but I had not spoken. The beating of my heart came back again. I had never heard the voice, as I had never seen the face, but it affected me in the same strange way. Again, in a moment, there arose before my mind innumerable pictures of myself. Lady Dedlock had taken shelter in the lodge before our arrival there, and had come out of the gloom within. She stood behind my Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.